This panel on anarchy and international solidarity was recorded September 25th, 2004. The panelists are Jaggi Singh, Sarah DeSantis, Mark Lance, and Andrew Willis. It was recorded at the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference in Plainfield, Vermont.
I guess we'll start. So this is a panel on anarchism and international solidarity, and the four of us are Mark from D.C., Andrew from D.C., Sarah from Burlington, Vermont, and myself, Jaggi, from Montreal. We discussed this a bit before, and we want to make it as discussion-oriented as possible, so we're going to limit our presentations to between 10 and 15 minutes, and then hopefully have a really good discussion, and the discussion won't be question-answer. Of course, if there are specific questions, we'll take a few at a time and get the answers. So I'm also in the role of a facilitator. Each of the panelists will introduce themselves more with more detail when they give their presentations, but between us, we're talking from experiences of doing international solidarity work in Chiapas, in Latin America, in Palestine, in East Timor, or not in East Timor, but around the issue of East Timor as well, and I guess some of us are dating ourselves with the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa back in the 80s. There's also other workshops that I want to tag in the schedule that where some of these discussions that we'll have now, because you know the problem is time. It's not each of us can't say everything we want to say in 10 to 15 minutes, but there's other workshops, and I just want to tag some of them. I think there's one on self-determination tomorrow that I think addresses some of the topics. That's something we've talked about over and over again. Self-determination. What does that mean? And there's an actual presentation that addresses that. Right after this presentation, there's a presentation on anti-authoritarianism and international solidarity, or why anarchists or why anti-authoritarians might be shoddy anti-imperialists, and I think that'll be really good and a great continuation of this discussion, and I know the person who's doing it and should be really good. There's one on horizontalism in Argentina, so I guess that might be a place also to explore some of these issues more in depth using a case study. And to plug my own, there's one on migration and borders where some of the points that I won't be able to make here get made in more detail in that presentation. So I'll start, and we're timing ourselves. So I guess a few provisos, because this is anarchism, international solidarity, and of course solidarity, broadly defined, can be addressed in a variety of ways within our communities, for example, with immigrant refugee communities or anti-poverty struggles. Indigenous sovereignty on Turtle Island, where we live, prisons and political prisoners. There's such a huge scope to the work of solidarity, period. But to focus, we're dealing with international solidarity. And I think it's important that we agree that we would give that proviso because an immediate point that comes up is, well, what are you doing at home, et cetera, et cetera. And we've only chosen this topic as a matter of focus. As well, and we discussed this too, and we agree that specifically, the topic of indigenous sovereignty and solidarity with indigenous sovereignty deserves a whole other panel. And it's an area that I believe anarchists need to reckon with more clearly in more, very specific ways, and you just can't mix things. So it's a matter of focus. Where I want to start is maybe with a definition of solidarity. I've been working on an actually written statement on solidarity, not that this is the final word, but just to try to come to terms with it, because that term solidarity, I usually end talks that I give with a word about solidarity, and now I'm starting with one because I think it's so essential to the work that we do as anarchists. And so what does that mean? What does solidarity mean? Why do I feel it's essential? Well, here's a definition that a friend of mine and I have worked on in Montreal. To talk about solidarity is to talk about struggle, social struggle, political struggle, because solidarity is born of struggle. It is rooted in the context where people are faced with the fundamentals of survival, whether it's meeting the basic needs of defending themselves against military and political aggression or fighting for the liberation. It's rooted in the very real choices that people are forced to make to survive and protect themselves and what they have, their family, their well-being, their culture, their land. Solidarity is expressed on an individual level, but more specifically in relation to the collective. Solidarity is about people, about collectivities. It's about seeing the links about my place in life and your place in life. It means making concrete links in a way that forges a commitment to directly engage with the social reality in which we live in order to change it. When we begin to engage with our social reality seriously, we confront the systems that define the terms of existence, the structures that determine who has freedom, who is served justice, and who merits life and dignity. This is where we begin to wrestle with the question of power, the powerful, the powerless, the power to stop being complicit in the oppressive regimes that govern our lives, and the power to counter its daily violence. When we see it in this way, we have no choice but to seek out alliances and build ties amongst people and communities that share these convictions. We have no choice but to seek out mutual aid and reciprocity, and these are the steps towards genuine solidarity. And I give that definition of genuine solidarity because it might seem obvious, but it's worth not assuming this, that we're not talking about charity, we're not talking about missionary-style work, although often we find ourselves feeling that way, of being involved in charity or missionary work. Solidarity is not something that I see as passivity, of being told what to do to help genuinely oppressed people. It's negotiating the idea of, as again the same friend expresses it, how we know when to lead and when to follow. So when you have that definition of solidarity, clearly the issue isn't, you know, do we get involved? It's that we have to be involved. It's almost a basic definition of changing the world. It is the basic definition of changing the world, of engagement in these struggles. And for me, you come to terms with dealing with a basic definition here of what is anarchism? What is anarchism? And for me, what I see as anarchism, which has been expressed by other thinkers as well, is that the ideas of anarchism, those ideas of mutual aid and of freedom and of self-determination, they derive from struggle. This has been expressed in different ways. The organizational platform of the anarcho-communists mentions this. It's been expressed in so many different ways. Rudolf Rocker, in his definition of direct action, talks about direct action being whenever, in his words, workers, but you can expand that to mean anybody who's fighting against oppression, whenever workers directly engage in warfare against their oppressor. And just to give an historical example, you know, Peter Kropotkin looked back at the French Revolution, others did as well, which wasn't an anarchist revolution. The word anarchism, as far as I know, wasn't even used, but looked at that struggle to see these ideas as they expressed themselves in the context of a political struggle. And my point is that we should be doing that now with struggles that aren't defined as anarchist in any way, but where we see these ideas of autonomous organizing or of self-determination or fighting for basic dignity emerge. So in many ways, what I often feel is that in our anarchist scene or movement, we've excavated certain ideals already about mutual aid, et cetera, and we're somehow looking for where that's being expressed elsewhere. Without understanding that, I feel that they're expressed in different ways in different places in time, and Kropotkin did it, or others did it, for a certain period of time, but we have to continually renew that process. So for me, renewing the anarchist tradition, the theme of the conference, is all about engaging struggles of resistance worldwide. Chiapas, Palestine, indigenous communities, Bolivia, et cetera, et cetera. There were some guiding questions that that we have. They're in the description of this panel. I wrote them down somewhere. They're here as well. Okay. I don't want to talk in riddles or anything, but in many ways, the questions are the answers, and the answers are the questions. and my point is that the questions that we ask about how we do our solidarity work is in many ways sort of leading to certain answers. And I say that, and I kind of feel bad about talking that riddle, because I'm not here to provide the answer of how we engage in perfect solidarity work and can feel good about being an anarchist or whatever. But rather, the way these questions are posed, maybe, you know, outline paths towards potential answers. So how do we practice direct solidarity and maintain accountability to the movements and people that we're aiming to support? How do we navigate support for autonomy and self-determination with movements that are often articulated through ideologies of national liberation, political parties, organized religion, governments, states? What changes in anarchist thought and practice are necessary for the genuine practice of solidarity with movements of self-determination? And what are the limitations of our solidarity efforts? What are the limits of anarchists and anarchism in the practice of genuine solidarity? So What I'm going to do, because I don't have a lot of time and I'm running out of my time, is just offer some impressions, some points that I can't flush out. And I won't get really specific, and I can, so maybe that's maybe during questions, or you know, we have a weekend left, so you know, you can come up and talk to me. But I come from very specific experiences in doing solidarity work with the International Solidarity Movement with Palestine, as others on this panel, with the East Timor Alert Network, the Ogoni Solidarity Network, some Chiapa solidarity work in Vancouver. But I just want to maybe share general impressions. So on the issue of accountability, well, I guess one point to say, and this is something that comes up when we talk about anti-globalization, I feel that when we talk about anarchists doing anything, we seem to assume, or sometimes assume, for example, in the anti-globalization movement, that you know, anti-globalization equals anarchists. But we exist, you know, within umbrellas of struggle, where many, many people are involved in the exact same kind of work that we're doing. So that's something that needs to be navigated as well. And we find ourselves in situations of alliances with people who aren't anarchists. Another point that I should have made earlier is that there's really no limit to the scope of the work that we can do as solidarity activists. And a question that I pose is, why do we choose certain struggles over others, and how does that come to be? There is no limit to the scope of the work. It's just astounding the amount of the work that we could do in solidarity, and yet, you know, certain struggles come up time and time again in certain moments. Apartheid dominated at one point, now it's Palestine, Chiapas, Argentina, and yet you look at the entire African continent or indigenous struggles in Asia, etc. And so there's different kinds of work, and I've sort of navigated both because I've been involved with struggles that are, you know, small and not popular. And I say popular not because people are doing it because it's trendy, but popular in the sense that there's a wide knowledge of it. For example, West Papua, I'm not sure if anybody knows about West Papua, but trying to do some basic support with indigenous struggles in West Papua, where there's an incredible struggle going on. East Timor for a time was a struggle that didn't have much mainstream or wide knowledge of it. Sort of going all over the place, and there's not a lot of time, but accountability for me is, and navigating that accountability is about establishing what some people have called direct solidarity, direct links. There's nothing profound about saying that, but there are some interesting models or projects that show that in practice, and show that in struggles. Actually, the two examples I'm going to give are struggles that where you have the dominant movement, the resistance movement, is a movement that's Marxist-Leninist. And it's interesting that when that's the case, sometimes anarchists aren't reckoning with it and aren't engaging it. And we choose instead to opt out of any real engagement. And two examples are Cuba and Venezuela. One of the classic examples of anarchism in practice, or of solidarity in practice, and of this terrain of struggle being where the fighting is going on, is Spain, where, you know, a call out was made for people worldwide to actually go to Spain and fight. As far as I know, none of those call outs have been made for various struggles that we're involved with yet, to actually go and fight. But what would happen if Cuba, which is under attack right now, you know, was engaged in an actual war with the U.S. or needed to fight for support where our solidarity was asked for? And you know, we have to navigate that question of, is my enemy's enemy my friend or not? I just throw that out because Castro isn't necessarily our friend, and yet the liberation of Cuba is navigated through that Communist Party and Castro as well. The two examples I want to give of direct solidarity are two projects where activists in Montreal are involved with, which is something called PASC. It's an accompanying project in Colombia, where the FARC and the ELN, two Marxist-Leninist movements, dominate, and anarchists sort of opt out of engaging what that is and what's that about, except when anybody from FARC comes to speak to denounce them for being communists. And, you know, we should denounce them, but there is a struggle on the ground where those words, communist, anarchist, etc., I mean, their meaningfulness is questionable, very questionable. In Palestine, just to give another example, on the terrain, of course, there's jihad, there's Hamas, etc., etc., but people end up talking about Shabab, which are people who fight. And on the street, they're Shabab. In any case, project accompaniment, this accompanying project is all about establishing direct links with communities, and conceiving of ways where you can do effective work directly with any given community. In this case, it's being there. It's accompanying people who have to deal with paramilitaries and deal with government repression. Another example is in another part of Mexico, which gets a lot less attention than Chiapas, which is Guerrero, where the political movement, resistance movement there isn't one where we see aspects of autonomism and anarchism even that we see with the Zapatistas. It's the EPR, which is a classic Marxist-Leninist formation, guerrilla formation. And yet, there are ways of engaging that struggle, again, establishing direct links. And one of those direct links is a project, a very modest project. And these projects I'm talking about are very modest, and it goes to one of the points I hopefully I can make before my time runs out about our capacity to do solidarity. But and this project is something called Radio Libertad, which unites activists in Montreal with free radio activists in Mexico City with indigenous groups in resistance in Guerrero, who have made a very clear demand that they need communication networks. And we come from a tremendous amount of privilege where we could offer basic resources and training, etc. And hopefully, within the next few years, this transmitter will go up and help this effort at resistance there. 2 minutes left. Okay. Just a couple of other points. And again, I go back to my proviso that I'm throwing out points, and hopefully it'll engage the discussion.
We agreed we would yell out these
things. Yeah, it's good. I feel that when talking about anarchists and solidarity, there's a fear of engagement whenever flags and gods and all kinds of oppressions are associated with the solidarity that we have to do. And that is the nature of struggle. Struggle is messy. It's not stage managed. And I feel a lot of how we navigate political struggle, or what we call political struggle in North America, is stage managing it in a way that makes us feel fully comfortable about engaging with it. One way this is expressed is, it's fun. And that's fine. I don't want to totally denounce that, but the fact is, to do solidarity in a meaningful way means to engage, means to be standing beside those people who might chant Allahu Akbar at demonstrations or see the flag as a symbol of liberation. I guess the final point, or 2 points, hopefully I can make with 30 seconds. Maybe I can only make one. I'm sorry. I have to keep under time, which is our terrain of struggle. What is our terrain of struggle? As I said, with Spain, it was very clearly defined as going and fighting. With most of the struggles here, I think it's important to underline that the terrain of struggle when we're in the empire, like the heart of empire, is here for us. I mean, there's very tangible and important things that we can do, but ultimately what is expressed, I've heard expressed by the people who I'm in direct contact with and the movements that I'm in direct contact with through these various struggles I've talked about, is the terrain of struggle ends up being here. So ISM, for example, just to give one critique of ISM, seems to be about, often, raising the money so we can send people there. When, if you consider that the nature of the Palestinian liberation struggle would be completely different if you could undermine the American role in it, like completely different, radically different, and we're here in the heart of empire, I think we have to be clear about what the terrain of struggle is. The terrain of struggle is here. It doesn't mean like you stay here. I mean, direct solidarity and direct links means going back and forth, but really defining that clearly, that it's here. It can't be anywhere else. We're in Vermont, which is the closest state in the U.S. to Canada, but in terms of political culture, but this is the heart of empire. And the terrain of struggle is here, and I can't go into what that would mean on the ground here in terms of the struggles we engage with, but I'll just leave it at that. And turn it over to Sarah.
Yeah, we're going to go to
Sarah. Oh, you changed the order?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's Sarah.
Hi, my name is Sarah DeSantis, and I'm an organic vegetable farmer and a collectively run farm in Burlington, Vermont. And I've also done solidarity work in Chiapas, Oaxaca, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and most recently I worked with the International Solidarity Movement in the West Bank and Palestine. And I'm going to mostly draw from experiences that I had in the West Bank and working with the ISM. So when I go do solidarity work, international solidarity work, I don't go to promote anarchist theory. That's not a goal of mine at all. And I think a lot of what I'm going to say today is probably going to piss some people off, but I'm going to say it anyways, because it doesn't go along with a lot of what I've heard, you know, other anarchists speak about when doing solidarity, but I'm going to say them anyways. So of course I'm going, when I go to do solidarity work, it's to break down hierarchical structures and to hopefully fight for liberatory struggles. But again, I'm not pushing anarchist theory. And usually, you know, when you think about self-determination and what that means, most people that are fighting for the right for self-determination don't have an anarchist society in their dreams. That's not what they're fighting for. And we, as anarchists or as activists, I don't believe have any right to push that on societies that are in struggle, because it's their self-determination. It's not for us to determine what their future will be, just as, you know, it's not the right of the U.S. government to impose so-called democracy on any other country or people. And I've saw many anarchists, both in Chiapas and Palestine, not just anarchists, but activists in general, being really pushing anarchist ideals on communities that weren't ready to hear those ideals, and seeing a lot of doors shut in their face, and I thought a lot of it was actually quite disrespectful, which I'll give some examples of that later. I just want to briefly mention the idea, the issue of state. When we talk about Palestine, Palestine is not a state, it's not a country, it's a place. It's not clearly defined what Palestine is. It's olive trees and amazing people and agriculture. But they don't have a state, and I think at this point in history, it's actually a privilege to be able to live in a place where you have a state. And I know as an anarchist, that's a crazy thing to say, of course. You know, in my dream society, there wouldn't be a state. But, you know, for all the different political factions and all the different political parties that are in Palestine, the vast majority do want a state. And, you know, we don't think about it as a privilege here. Oh, we have a state. You know, it's totally oppressive. It's oppressing the world. But the fact is they live under colonization. They live under having to go through checkpoints, waiting at checkpoints for 3 hours, having to go through three checkpoints, maybe to go 20 miles and maybe never getting there, having your house demolished. You know, this is all part of occupation. And, you know, a Palestinian state that ever comes to power will not be liberatory. It will probably be oppressive. But hopefully it will be better than the Israeli occupation. And this is what the Palestinian people are asking for. And I know this is very controversial. A lot of people I've talked about don't agree with me at all saying that. But I think they have, Palestinians have every right to have a state if that's what they're wanting. And again, it's not something I'd necessarily agree with, but I would agree with it because it's the right to self-determination. I want to talk about being accountable to movements and people that we aim to support and how we can do that. And I think that biggest way is to respect the culture and learn about the culture before you go there. And, you know, if I was going to a Zapatista or a Palestinian village, obviously you don't drink alcohol because both cultures have asked you not to drink alcohol in their villages. Going into Palestine as a woman, I would wear long sleeves. I would dress conservatively. I would wear long pants because that's respecting the culture. I'll tell you this one little story. In Palestine, we were at a demonstration in this rural village that's going to be totally surrounded by the wall, and this sheep farmer invited Israelis and internationals who had come to the demonstration to have lunch, 15 of us, which was really amazing because he doesn't have a lot of money, obviously, and he's a sheep farmer, and so he gave us amazing sheep yogurt and sheep cheese. And one of the Israeli anarchists who was a vegan challenged him on why he was serving us cheese. And it was totally appalling because he's going to lose his land. He's not going to be a sheep farmer for much longer. And just seeing, I mean, that's obviously really extreme, and I don't think anyone hopefully here would ever do anything like that. But just showing how disrespectful people can be and not taking into consideration of what these people are actually going through. Also, respecting the culture, and this is incredibly controversial, it's one of the most controversial issues in the ISM, is talking about queer liberation. Palestine, queer liberation. Palestine is incredibly homophobic, and it's a huge issue, not only with Palestinians in general, but also the Palestinians in ISM, within ISM. And personally, I don't think we should go into large groups of Palestinians with Palestinians and talk about queer liberation, because it's not something they feel comfortable with right now, and it's not where they're at right now. And as, you know, I'm not going to go in and tell them I'm bisexual, for instance, because I would alienate myself, and I wouldn't be as effective as an organizer. There's an amazing lesbian organization happening, starting to be formed in Ramallah, and I think if people wanted to do that, that would be a great way to plug in, but not going into rural villages necessarily and talking about this openly with lots of Palestinians, because I don't think you're going to get very far. However, what I did, and I think was effective, was once you develop relationships with people who you know are homophobic, is talking to them about it one-on-one instead of in a large group, building a trust with a person and talking about, okay, you don't want to be oppressed by the Israeli government. You don't want the Israeli government and military deciding your future. Well, why are you trying to decide the future of someone who's lesbian or gay? And talking about it on a one-to-one level, and I think it's a lot more effective way to get across to people. And again, I'm sure lots of people disagree with me there. I just saw, you know, some of our culture is not, it's just not part of their culture yet. And hopefully, you know, hopefully most of our culture won't ever be part of their culture. We should clarify on that. But, you know, some of the hopefully liberatory things that we work on here will be introduced in other parts of the world, but I think it takes time. The final thing about being accountable to movements is really thinking about how your actions are going to affect that community. For example, in Palestine, you might find yourself in between Shabab, boys, Palestinian boys who throw rocks at Israeli tanks and soldiers or border police. And sometimes it's a good idea to continue standing there, and sometimes it's not, and you should think about that. You standing there as kind of human shield or, you know, encouraging the boys to continue throwing stones, which might be a great thing, which might be, you know, at that demonstration or just passing in the street, it might be the appropriate thing to do, but you might be in a community where the village doesn't want their boys. They don't want them in the streets, and most of the village doesn't want that to happen. So you really just have to think about what your actions do, because as internationals, you can leave the situation. You don't have to live with the repercussions of what happens to that village the next day, because you can leave. But the village has to live for the rest of their lives with the repercussions of your actions. And you know, when you're there, you just have no idea what long-lasting effect you're really going to have on a place where you're introducing all kinds of Western ideals or whatever, activist culture. Some of them which may be good, and some of them which really may be detrimental to the culture. So just to keep that in mind. I just want to wrap up by saying I think there are ways to introduce non-hierarchical and more liberatory methods of organizing when you're doing international solidarity work that aren't imposing, but are more a gentle form and not so abrupt. For instance, quite often, well, not only in Palestine, but also in Chiapas, quite often it's the men who meet to decide where the struggle is going to go or what the demonstration is going to look like. But sometimes there'll be women present or certain political factions that haven't been able to speak that are in the room. And just raising your hand saying, I'd love to, you know, I've heard your point of view, but I'm just trying to get a sense of the whole community. And could you share with us the ideas of the women or something like that? And it's just a way to be inclusive, like I think most anarchists try to be in their organizing. Just gentle things like that so we can hear other people's voices and so everybody in the room can hear other people's voices and concerns. Another thing we did was when we first got to this rural village in Palestine called Budrus, beautiful village if you ever go there, most beautiful places I've ever been on this earth. You know, as international women, we can meet with the men and we can meet with the women, but you know, the women, Palestinian women, it's a really awkward situation because as international women, you can go meet with Palestinian men and talk about demonstrations and talk about where the struggle's going. Great, thank you. But Palestinian women can't necessarily do that. So we, you know, we were talking to some women and we decided, oh, we should have a women's meeting for for the Palestinian women and for the international women. And it was a great way to hear their concerns, hear the projects they were already working on that the men hadn't told us about, and that we could help them on. A lot of projects related to children and just having children's parties and having fun in the community for the kids. Because that's part of international solidarity too, is having joy with these people who live under occupation their entire life. So I think I'm going to end there.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm passing out some handouts because I like to get handouts at panels, and just because. It's better to get this stuff sort of from the horse's mouth. This is just communiques, basically, that have to do with international solidarity, so I thought it would be appropriate. So first of all, as Jai said earlier, this is international solidarity, and there could be a whole other panel on indigenous solidarity that, so I'm not going to cover, we would have to start with how we have to suspend our concept of time. This is a lot to go into there. I guess I'm going to be referring to the Zapatistas, and by Zapatistas I mean the EZLN-based communities. I don't mean the EZLN political military structure. There's a lot you can get into with the language too, so I just want to put that disclaimer out. But also on the subject of these handouts, that I'm not trying to encourage the reification of this guy Marcos, who is not the EZLN or the Zapatistas. As a spokesperson, but we really need to deconstruct, I think, that mythology that we have helped build up around this one person. But starting with sort of something that's in there, civil society has a huge role, as the Zapatistas call civil society, international solidarity. We've provided critical support, well, we're called the third shoulder in one of those communities. They constructed their movement partially to sort of draw in ours, to draw in an international solidarity movement pretty effectively. And anarchists play lots of roles within those different movements, within different kinds of solidarity. Reel off some. I guess they could fall into different categories, different kinds of anarchist solidarity work, but from what I've seen, anarchists raise money and send donations of medical supplies, send radio transmitters, send all kinds of things, is the idea. Provide refugee relief. They do political actions to raise awareness, provide publicity. And also, especially important, is sort of reflecting and internally reflecting and changing based on a solidarity practice that as they've experienced it in Chiapas and elsewhere. So having said that, just trying to address accountability, as some of the questions that the Jagi has posed. How do we maintain accountability, and how do especially anarchists do this? And I think the most important thing to do is just to ask questions. And as we've been encouraged to do time and again, those of us who have gone down to Chiapas who sort of liaise with the communities. They call it asking we walk. So that we can't really move forward until we know what our role is. And I think that not making assumptions about what our role should be is very important. It's something we don't do near enough. It applies to all solidarity movements, but also sort of just so defining that role and how we can help and is a tenuous thing, and there are like some egregious examples of people not following through with that. At least one collective of people who included anarchists has raised money for different projects for Zapatista communities and told them what the money was going to be used for. The big example is told them that this should be for a library when these people didn't have water, didn't have running water, didn't have anything. So it's a ridiculous example, but there are variations thereof. And also as far as accountability, just taking initiative to be transparent. Different groups raise lots of money. They do different kinds of political actions, but not always liaising with communities or with people who work with the communities to see if this would be okay with the communities. Different kinds of actions or different kinds of ways of even raising money. And also, also really important on that note, was just bypassing intermediaries. And what Jackie calls direct solidarity, I think, is really important because there are lots of groups who purport to work with Zapatistas, with the rebel communities, but may not at all, or may sort of work with those who have something to do with the Zapatistas but aren't really getting support or getting information from the source. And so I think that it's a really difficult thing to do. But there are lots of groups who are, especially in the United States, who are sort of like the dominant, like Global Exchange, Mexico Solidarity Network. And these are really, these groups do really great work. But what's happened a lot is, I mean, there have been anarchists who have gone down with literally fistfuls of money or, you know, or literally 50 to 100 bikes, and they dropped them off with people who immediately sold them to the PRI, the ruling party, the police who destroyed them. This has happened lots of times. So it's just in terms, even, you know, definitely in terms of material support, it's really important to not go through intermediaries. But in general, making that commitment to have long-term relationships and really seek out, to seek out those relationships. So trust those working closest, I guess, with the Zapatistas, the compas. And again, seeking that out isn't easy, but I guess not trusting as much what large groups are saying, but rather what people working in Chiapas, you know, people who have those kinds of relationships, say is important. And also, in terms of navigating support for a movement for national liberation is a really important question, and it's especially important because in terms of the Zapatistas, they've defined their movement as being a Mexican movement. It is a national project, and so there really is no place for North Americans, or at least that's what we call North Americans. So it's important to just think about that it's a supporting role, and it's totally defined by the people who are within this national project. And but also at the same time saying that our movements should be the focus here locally. That not support for a Mexican project, but rather the terrain of struggle, again, as Jackie said, should be here locally, should be locally grown. And so that's something I think really important to keep in mind, especially as this is a supposedly national liberation project. But also some interesting questions come up, I think, in that project, which is in terms of how to be involved to call attention to what's going on in Chiapas. There have been lots of debates within some anarchist groups, I think, about whether or not to call on, like, the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner to investigate abuses, you know, whether to put political pressure on the local governments. So I don't have the answer there, but those have been debates that have come out. Should we call on the State Department, who's always had a neutral role? You know, these are continual debates, I guess. And also, as far as governments are concerned, the Zapatistas wholeheartedly endorse a large role for the local governments and the state government in Chiapas, and that really makes some anarchists uncomfortable. It has made. And so the question is, you know, how do we navigate that? And I think that definitely we need to accept that there is a role for them. If the Zapatistas are comfortable with that, then we're comfortable with that kind of thing. Whatever our supporting role is, has been defined. And the same goes with the Catholic and Protestant churches, which have really big roles there too. Local churches are, you know, mainline Zapatista organizers. And so sort of accepting that reality, I think, is an important thing to do, and it has been something that groups I've gone down with have questioned pretty heavily. And as Sarah mentioned, that's a really unacceptable thing to do, to question them outright for having a relationship with the Catholic Church. And limits of anarchism and anarchists and within the solidarity movement. I think, as I've said, that anarchists do feel have felt uncomfortable with a movement that does have strong links to state governments, but also that explicitly denies being anarchist, which is a funny thing. Some primitivists have actually said that they're not anarchist enough. They're not anarchist enough, and that means they're invalid, which is a hilarious argument to make. That to judge this movement isn't anarchist enough, but so that's something I think that's a limitation for some people anyway, and also that Mexican anarchists have a much more diverse role within the Zapatista Solidarity movement, at least, than North American anarchists have had, if nothing else than because they're part of the nationalist project, right? This national liberation movement, but also they've been able to maintain and develop the kind of relationships that are ideal in these communities, that are long-term, that don't look just to being in a peace camp for 2 to 3 weeks. And so I think that for the way, at least, the anarchist solidarity is practiced by a lot of people who've gone to Chiapas, it's a really temporary thing. And as far as just ending with changes to anarchist thought and practice for solidarity, obviously I think the big thing is just being flexible, and not confining ourselves to these rigid ideological roles or norms. That's pretty obvious. Not let them define our tactics of solidarity, which means sometimes raising money is what we're called on to do, basically. As those communiques point out, millions of dollars have been poured in the last couple of years that have critically really supported communities that are facing 10 kinds of different onslaught of destruction. So there's lots of different roles there that we're not often comfortable taking on. And also just not idealizing their struggle, not idealizing it as something above, especially what we're building locally, which I see happen a lot. It's the Zapatistas, it's reified. So I think it's really important to couch our solidarity in terms of how we're working locally. And in that respect, I think the most important thing that we can do is what has been called on of us. And solidarity means, first of all, understanding Zapatismo for whatever it means to you, but also applying it from whatever you take from Zapatismo, from whatever the practice is. This metaphor of the mirror is that their movement is a mirror for ours. Not that it's like a model or anything like that, but that they become very accountable within these communities to themselves, to each other, to the way they practice governance, and so that we should, think about applying these kinds of things. If we're interested in the fact that they are really accountable, really transparent, that we also, start taking account of our internal dynamics, of our shortcomings, of our hypocrisies, and strategically analyzing that stuff. And one last thing is that I think there's often a disconnect between what we find fulfilling or interesting about the movement there and what our role is, what our best role is, basically. That some folks just like there are some people who go down to Chiapas and hang out there, and that's great. And then then we hear the base communities complain that they wish they'd been doing more work, in the United States. Sometimes it's vice versa, but that basically, again, going back to the idea of asking first, sort of before jumping in. I think that's it.
I actually think most of the interesting questions, I'm Mark, around solidarity have to be asked pretty specifically, in specific contexts, that there's very few general kind of principles that you can come up with that are going to go very far. But the specific thing I wanted to kind of talk through some thoughts I've been having about what it means concretely to, that is to say, who you're supposed to be in solidarity with, and concretely what the kind of communication looks like. And I want to go through a couple different examples that I've been involved with to clarify what I mean. So in the early and mid-80s, I was very involved in solidarity work with Nicaragua during the Franco War. So there you had a case where, sort of you were in solidarity with, a government. I mean, right? You have to send it east to government. we, most of us, had some differences with the Sandinista government, even beyond the being a government part. And one thing I want to say is I absolutely reject the idea that being working in solidarity means supporting whatever the oppressed do. I mean, some people put it that way. I think several earlier people have said that, you know, this sort of the Dan Rather theory, right, when he said after September 11th, said, Bush is my commander-in-chief, and you just tell me where to line up. Well, I find a lot of activists who, you know, say, well, Noriega is my commander-in-chief. Well, this is absurd. I mean, oppressed people can do stupid things. They can do self-destructive things. They can do oppressive things to other people. They can do evil things just like anyone else. And part of what it is to take someone seriously as a human being is to recognize that they can do wrong stuff. And that's absolutely not to say, and I absolutely agree with the things that I was saying, that speaking to an oppressed person from a position of privilege in the United States is completely different than speaking to one another. And you don't make the arguments in the same way, and you don't get to say everything that I would say, you know, to Peter. I don't get to go to Palestine and say, and there's ignorant and blind and contextless ways that people do that that are very destructive. But it's also not true to go to the other extreme to say, well, you know, whatever you do, I'm behind you. Right, so that's what I was. But at any rate, I mean, the questions there, in a certain sense, you know, about how to navigate what counted as solidarity work with Nicaragua was actually pretty easy. Because after all, this is a country under massive assault by a terrorist army being funded by my country. And so, in a way, it was just clear. Get the, you know, stop the terrorist assault was so overwhelmingly the obvious strategy that there wasn't a lot of debate, and everything else was kind of a window dressing in the face of that. In the mid and late 80s, I was very involved in the South African apartheid, anti-apartheid struggle, specifically working when I was a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh with people like Dennis Brutus. We were getting Pitt to divest. And so there, you know, being in solidarity with the South African people concretely meant speaking to the ANC. You know, as in any of these cases, one can always have personal relationships with particular people, right? You know this and that person. But personal relationships are, well, personal relationships, a relationship with, you know, your friend in Ramallah or your friend in Cape Town. And you can support them, but if you're supposed to be working in solidarity with a people, that is a different thing. And you wonder, well, who speak? You know, most of us aren't in a position to go do a big survey of the people in South Africa. So you have to listen to somebody that's got some authority and some credibility with large numbers of people. And in a certain sense, I always found it relatively easy because the ANC, again, while you might not have, one might not have agreed with them on everything, you respected them. I did anyway. I thought it was easy to respect them. This was an organization that you took seriously, respected both broadly politically and in terms of political tactics and strategy. And they had some. They were engaging in, you know, they had strategic ideas. They sent, one of the things they did was systematically send representatives to campuses all over the U.S. and talk about the debates that were going on underground in neighboring countries, and talk to us, and actually also listen. You know, they were very interested in what sort of problems were coming up for the organizing in the U.S. that maybe there was some way for them to work with and stuff. And so we saw ourselves, you know, solidarity with the South African struggle, you know, on a day-to-day basis meant solidarity with the ANC. And to a certain extent, anybody who wasn't willing to accept that was someone you tended not to trust. Then I worked, the next, I did many things, but the next sort of instance of international solidarity was during the first Intifada, where I first got involved in working on Palestinian issues. And there was, again, a connection that you could feel fairly good with. There were partly because the PLO was in exile and was so radically separated off from the population, and because there was a sort of breakdown, people were forced onto their own resources, and neighborhood committees grew up that were largely took on a kind of coalition structure. So you had representatives of Hamas, representatives of Hezbollah, representatives of the PFLP, representatives of Fatah, who would, in each neighborhood, who would work together in a committee and come up with plans for carrying on this this intifada. And it was actually quite a real kind of, in many ways, a renaissance kind of time in Palestine. A lot of groups that hadn't been as involved in decision-making, certainly a lot of women's groups, became very much more prominent in this period. And it was possible it was more difficult to be in communication with these groups than it had been in the case of South Africa, for one thing, that not there wasn't always good communication between the villages and things like this. And it was much harder for any of them to come here. But there was communication, sometimes through the Israeli left, and who would go over, and sometimes through ourselves. And we kind of knew who we were working with, and they had credibility on the street, and they were part of the ongoing struggle. Now I come to the Second Intifada. And I want to ask the question of, when we say things like, we're in solidarity with the Palestinian people, I want to know what the hell we mean. Who are these people that you talk to, that you take your leadership from? I'm going to probably offend some people here today. I want to claim that there's no leadership that has broad support in the Palestinian community and which is a sort of group that you could feel comfortable working with. Yes, we should put on hold many of our ideals when working with groups, but not all of them. I'm not working in, you know, I will cooperate in local particular things with people associated with Hamas, but I'm not working in solidarity with the project of Hamas. I'm perfectly happy with the Palestinian state. I'm not happy with an Islamic state. I'm not going to, you know, choose to spend my time working for an Islamic state. Hamas is the only organization that right now has widespread credibility. All the polls suggest that they would, in fact, win an open election if an open election were held in the occupied territories. And if you included the camps, they'd win by an overwhelming majority. The PLO, the PNA, is absolutely beyond hope. I'll give you one little example of that connects just with the specifics of trying to do solidarity work and the tactical failures. I was involved in the writing of a kind of op-ed piece because an old comrade and friend of mine in Ramallah had written it and then asked for some help editing. It was basically a statement calling for the release of Marwan Barghouti and making connections between his status as a political prisoner and various people in the South African struggle. Now, for people that don't know, Marwan is probably the only secular identified person that anyone thinks has broad credibility. I mean, there's various people that are leaders in, you know, this town or this village or this region or that, but, you know, Marwan's got credibility across there. Look, I mean, he's not a radical. He's actually a Fatah guy. He's a lot less corrupt than Arafat. He's a lot probably more progressive than Arafat and Dahlan and people like this, but the reality is, if you're looking for someone who's a broadly secular leader, inclusive, who's got some credibility, that's it. Well, so this thing got written, just calling for his release and saying, you know, here's it. My friend approached everyone on the Palestine National Assembly. No one was willing to sign this. Zero people. He began approaching, he said, well, shit, we can't get political here, so we'll go to academics and sort of prominent, sort of other kind, politically prominent people like Mustafa Barghouti, for people who know him. Zero people. No one would sign this. Because everybody thought that supporting Barghouti meant undercutting their own position in the future potential someday Palestinian state. Well, this is just depressing. If you can't even get an op-ed published calling for the release of a political prisoner. So what does this mean? Well, I want to say, and this is a part of the offense, I think that, I want to come back to Jackie's point. I think in the case of Palestine, it is absolutely essential to recognize that the struggle is here. I've talked for a long time with Tanya Reinhardt, who's maybe the most prominent Israeli leftist on that. No, but one of them certainly. Partly the struggle is here because it's the only place there's any hope for a successful struggle. There isn't a Palestinian resistance that's accomplishing anything. What do I think? I love ISM. I talk to ISM people every day. I support ISM. But the idea that sending a few thousand Americans over there to join in struggles in Palestine, the idea that that's going to change the situation is nonsense. It isn't. It absolutely is not. There's no conceivable way it's going to. It can accomplish three things, I think. For one, there's some temporary local protection provided by having foreigners with white skin and stuff over there. It's very temporary because as soon as you leave, everything you accomplish can be destroyed with, you know, a couple thousand dollars of military equipment. But it's nonetheless anyway. Secondly, it gives Palestinians a sense that somebody else in the world gives a shit, which is very important psychologically, because there's a very widespread sense that they're completely ignored, and you know, that's been changing a bit in the last couple of years because of things like ISM. So that's very important. The most important role that I think ISM plays is that it educates Westerners who go there. It lets them see Palestinian society, it lets them see what's going on concretely, it lets them have some personal contacts with some people. But it's crucial to see that all of those are kind of subsidiary to the basic struggle. I mean, I want to say it's very much like Nicaragua. We've got a country that's providing, you know, in given average year, about $5 billion worth of military equipment to the Israeli state to completely destroy Palestinian society. That's the target. Ask any Palestinian, that's the target. That's our job, is to stop that, is to focus on the concrete struggles that are doing that. Not to, you know, if it's useful for that to go to Palestine and march to the wall, cool, do go to Palestine, march to the wall so that you can further that. But I think that to focus the struggle on anything other than that is just misguided. One of the beauties of that is that you can then do that without, you don't, you know, because that's an uncontroversial project that everyone in Palestine will support you in doing, you can do it without having to address these questions of who exactly it is you can talk to, or who you can look to as the leadership of the movement. Frankly, in my view, there isn't a leadership of the movement, or at least not one that you could really respect. But still in all, we can get the boot of empire off of their throats. Sorry, I just lost a thought. But anyway, so I think that's you know, where we have to see this going. We have to hope that we can turn around the kind of global power structure so that a meaningful leadership in Palestine could arise to actually build something. Because right now, wouldn't matter if there was a leadership. They can't. The practical reality is that no one can do anything there. So I mean, what I'm working with this year, I helped found a group called Stop U.S. Tax Aid to Israel Now, but actually this year I'm working more with, I'm on the steering committee of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, which in some ways is a group that makes some people nervous. It's a very moderate sort of coalition focused around international law, but it's a tactical coalition. It's a coalition that says, look, what we got to do is change the power dynamics, and the easiest way to bring everyone together is around principles of international law, because as long as you can say there's ethnic cleansing and occupation going on, then you can say that all sort of support for the state of Israel is illegal, and that's the only project that matters right now. Anyway, so I'll stop.
Okay. So we have a good 40 minutes for discussion. There's one thing I forgot to say in my intro, which is there was supposed to be another panelist here, Mustafa Henaway, who's with the ISM in Jenin, but he decided not to come because of fears at the border. Mustafa's from Toronto, but he's also Arab. I think it's important just to mention that he was supposed to be here, but the border meant that he decided not to come. Let's start the discussion. And we want to kind of avoid Q&A, although there are things that we might need to respond to. So we're going to take three or four comments/questions.